Yo, what's good? Level 20, episode 12, After Dark. I'm Connor Smith. We got Josh Berman and Friedel Cody on this one, as always. And joining us is Parker White. Had a super entertaining conversation with him. Know you're going to enjoy it. Just a reminder that movies 1 through 10, balanced through refresh, will be free on our website forever. But movies 11 through 19, that is, I Trip Through Zigzag, will only be free until the end of this podcast series when episode 20 comes out, and that'll be on November 10th. So any of the movies starting with I Trip, if you want to see them, make sure you're paying attention when it comes out, because Zigzag will only be up for a week, Habit will be up for 2 weeks, and so on and so forth. So just FYI. If you're looking for goggles for the new season, check out our website. We got our new spy collabs for sale, a couple different frame styles. Tour stops appearing for our romance tour on the calendar, on the website, all the time. Check it out, level1.ski, and click on the events page. Find something near you, and if you don't see anything near you, consider hosting your own stop and get your homies together, show the movie, and support your local club, support a cause, support yourself, whatever you want to do. This week's your last chance to buy tickets for our Denver world premiere on September 21st, so make sure you check that out if you're in the Colorado area and you want to come. If you want to fly in, you want to come, buy some plane tickets, go on the website, buy a ticket, buy eight for your friends, because they might sell out sometime soon. All right, enough about that stuff. Here's Parker White, After Dark. Did you hear us telling Josh and Friedel's side of the story of meeting you for the first time at Skull Candy Shoot in Squaw, I believe?
No, I didn't hear that one.
Do you remember that? What's your recollection of meeting these dudes for the first time?
Meeting Berman and Friedel for the first time?
Yeah.
Or do you even have one? Or have we just been ever present?
I've known you guys forever, man.
you're my dad.
I thought that the first time that we met was in Mammoth at the refresh shoot.
That's funny.
Well, it was before that. It was at the Skull Candy shoot that Jimbo brought you up for the year before
in Squaw,
2008.
Oh yeah,
but I had no recollection either.
Well, I remember that now, but I totally forgot. But because I think Mike Wilson was there, and he was like, "You guys got to hit the jump first. Like, you guys are the rookies."
Probably.
We hit that jump, but I don't remember very much about it. I remember being at the Shea Boo Boo afterwards with Jimbo.
Yeah.
I remember you guys getting a couple of your typical tricks of the time. And I remember, just because the footage going back through it actually jogged my memory. But the funny anecdote that somebody else told me, you might have told me at one point, but apparently we were down at whatever the bar was in the base area, and you came up to me to say something about shooting with Level One at some point. I was like, yeah, man, enter Super Unknown.
Oh, yeah. Classic. Good advice, too.
But it's funny, though. The first recollection I had of meeting you was in Mammoth when we were there for the big Mammoth shoot for Refresh, and you guys were obviously invited to hit the jump, but we were at a party at some mansion, one of those nights.
One of those condos. That was was it XD's house or something?
Yeah, it totally was. But I went to that party, and you guys were running around. You were running around with a squirt gun, shooting people. And I was dude, this kid's such a little punk. Fucking knock it off, dude.
Yeah, you weren't wrong either. I was watching all the After Dark footy, and that was even before that. And I was like, oh man, little Parker was such a punk, dude. And had all the wrong influences and thought all the wrong stuff was cool. And, it was so funny.
Yeah, even turned out all right.
Yeah.
Ish.
I suppose. Ish. I was even having a good laugh, watching Chris's intro to his segment, where he's just standing there with all the fog behind him, super cool guy in it, and he kind of looks to the side all handsome and cool.
That was clearly his idea.
it was so funny, though, just looking back on all that stuff.
I mean, you guys were both 18, 19 that year, 2011.
I think I was 19 that year.
Well, you turned 19, filming though 18, yeah?
Yeah, probably. I was born in 91 May, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Word.
Yeah, that was. Are we?
Oh, wait, hold up. We're talking. Oh, yeah. I was talking. I trip. I trip. You would have turned 20 in 2011 for After Dark. Yeah, word.
Yeah, because I remember being 20 filming Sunny.
Yeah.
And then I turned 21 spring.
So you're 19 turning 20 for After Dark.
Yeah, nice. I was 19 years old. I will say one of the funny things, like my intro in that segment, mm-hmm. where I'm like drunk and kind of stumbling down the alley and whatever.
Mm-hmm. You practiced that for a while.
Yeah, yeah. All you got to do is act naturally. Now, my mom is still upset about that.
Really?
Yeah, she hates that. She hates that intro with a passion. She said that I looked like such a jerk. And she was so upset about it, Berman, that she almost wrote you a letter saying
that. Oh, no. And
I think my dad was like, yeah, Melina, like, do not write Parker's like new filmers and employers a letter from his mom saying that she hated the movie and she was so upset and everything. Yeah, she still hates that though. She talks about it.
Well, I mean, she's taking it literally and it reflects poorly as a mother.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just
my child is a bum.
It was like just acting, you know, but yeah. Just funny. Just funny. She was just like, I hate that.
That was the summer you came to Denver for like a month.
Yeah, it was so much fun. Remember those like bike parades we'd go to and everything?
Oh yeah, that was every Wednesday night. It was what was it called?
It was like a group bike ride.
Yeah,
bunch of nerds,
hundreds of people,
like wild style.
Nice
Denver Cruisers.
Yeah.
Denver Cruisers. Yeah, we used to do that. That's fun.
Loose.
Yeah, that was cool.
That was the summer of the squirrel, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Oh my god.
I heard you found that thing in the bedroom.
Well, I didn't find it, but I was like being blamed for this room smelling super bad.
So the backstory there real quick. So you'd showed up and we're sleeping in the guest room for a few nights, and it was like the week before the 4th of July. And my ex was like, man, Parker, he smells so bad. He doesn't shower, which was true, man. You weren't into showering at the time, which is completely cool.
Yeah, still not.
I didn't necessarily think that meant you smelled. I wasn't picking up on that, but there was an odor coming out of that room, and it would kind of come and go. It wasn't necessarily like permeating the whole house or anything, but it's like, man, that room definitely stinks. All right, like Parker fucking smells. That's okay though. That's okay.
Yeah.
And then you guys took off for Uray for the 4th of July, and the ex is like, oh yeah, well, let's just take all of Parker's stuff and put it out on the porch and air it out. And it's like, okay, cool. And the smell like kind of went away a little bit, or at least it's
placebo effect.
Exactly.
Yeah, placebo.
Straight
yeah,
up
I don't
placebo
think that actually...
effect. And then you got back and we put your stuff back in the room, and it was either that first night that you were back or second night, whatever, but you got back, you went to sleep, and then you like busted out of that room at like 11 a.m. because you'd closed the door, and we're just like, holy shit, like it smells so fucking bad of like rotting carcass, like something is horribly wrong in there. And we went through like everything trying to find whatever the source of the smell was, and just straight up couldn't find it. It's like, man, like what the fuck. And then I remember I went out maybe with Decker or Shuey, and we were actually scouting one of those like haunted house places in Denver. It's like a commercial like Halloween house, looking for locations to shoot your
intro and stuff.
Yeah. And then like I got a text photo from either Friedel or Decker, like, we found the source of the smell. And it was this like horrific photo of this like swollen mass of, well, it was a squirrel,
flesh.
But like we didn't even know what the fuck it was. It was
it had like eyes and teeth and stuff though, but it was so mutilated. That was so nasty. I bet if that photo still exists, you should post that or
it
something.
Does.
Yeah, I have it does. I have it on my Facebook.
It's so graphic and so bad.
It's so foul. Like, we couldn't even identify what kind of animal it was. Is it a cat? Is it a raccoon? Is it like, because it was so swollen that it was like three times the size of what a squirrel should be. And I remember coming back, like, what the fuck do we do about this? And I called these like biohazard like cleanup companies, and they all wanted like $500 to deal with it. And I remember saying like, Parker, I'll give you $100 if you want to go just like grab that thing and throw in a plastic bag. And we'd actually had a hazmat suit that I'd got as a costume to shoot for All Mets intro, and like one of those like crazy World War II looking gas masks. And like you put on the full gear and went in after this thing and effectively just kind of like knocked it off the shelf, fell on the floor, just like exploded. Maggots flew everywhere, and you like went running out. We all like screamed like little girls.
Yeah. $100 though. That's an easy job.
Yeah.
That's an easy $100. Yeah. Dude. That smell was, I know that we're just beating the dead squirrel, but it was so foul. Like I cannot stress enough how truly sharp and pungent and like face punching that smell was.
Death stink. Yeah. Like it's a death stink.
Yep.
It was really bad. Anyways, so that was nice.
Yeah. So two losses there. One, unfortunately, so I'd had this collection of old Level One movie posters that I'd had all the athletes sign. And this was like prize collection. I'd kept it in the basement prior to that summer. And then it was like, man, like we had a flood in the basement. Like I never want to lose this shit. Where's the safest place in the house I can put this? It's in the closet in the guest room. The fucking squirrel died on top of this poster tube and rotted right through it. And I had to toss the whole thing of like,
yeah,
the best. Ah, yeah.
RIP all around.
Yeah.
Squirrel lost a life there too. Dude, something I just want to make a note of real quick before we move on from it. But the key to that whole intro in the alley was those psychedelic glasses. Hypnosis glasses. Which,
yeah.
So I had had the idea in Mammoth that spring to film like a big hypnosis circle that would spin.
Hmm.
And I think I was going to try to do it with you while we were in Mammoth. And I don't know if you remember that, but I might have mentioned it to you. I had to have mentioned it to you. But we never ended up filming it. I was going to like paint the spiral thing and have him like spin it around.
Mm.
But it was in your head because then you found those glasses, or your mom did maybe?
I was with my mom in this like weird old junk toy store or something. And we found them. And I was like, oh, these would be so cool.
Because I remember you said, you're like, dude, I found that spiral, but like in glasses. And I was like, this is fucking serendipitous, dude. This is the illest shit. Like, this is way better than my idea of like spinning a cardboard fucking wheel.
So, Parker, what you're basically saying is that whole intro was your mom's idea.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Melina, no, I don't know if you remember this, but this is you.
You came up with this idea.
You like storyboarded this. But
yeah, she's like that.
The funny thing is I did storyboard that just to like create it, but there's absolutely nothing going on there. It's just you walking down an alley drinking and then the glass.
Yes. Yeah,
but then totally. The Shuey animated the spinning.
I think his friend did that because that was like some above next and level.
Beyond.
Yeah.
Some cutting edge stuff.
The vinyl like turntable starting up, which turned out sick. I always like really liked that.
Yeah.
Really. Yeah, cool. I really liked that too. And then when you're pouring the tea for me and everything.
Yeah, we had set up a green screen so that like we would try to film as many
in the dining room at the house. And you guys did that super late one night, and there's like every variation of just the most ludicrous shit
props
that you guys did green screen Parker doing.
Yeah, and I remember laughing so hard through some of those. Like, we had to cut, like, we couldn't even film or roll.
Oh, yeah.
So much fun.
We were just talking before we got started today about kind of how that stuff play, all the intros, the very extended intro with all the dark skiing, how that looks in hindsight, because Josh was saying that it wasn't received perhaps as positively as recent level work had been. What's your take watching that stuff again 8 years later? Like, how do you think that plays?
It's pretty funny, dude. Like, I remember being so proud of that segment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the segment's fire, no doubt.
Right. That was like my first full segment I'd ever filmed. And it was the first time I'd really filmed street and backcountry stuff. So I just remember personally being like, oh, that was such a great film and being so proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
And in retrospect, yeah, I did. I kind of watched it and I was like, what the hell was going on? Because a lot of those intros and stuff too, I just didn't think were that cohesive.
They're not.
Like,
no.
they're all just kind of all over the place. And it's sort of all of these half-baked ideas.
Yeah,
exactly.
Thrown together, but nothing really, like, there's no connecting the dots or no overall theme there. It was like all of these random ideas thrown into a big pot. And I don't think that it really works, to be honest. But with that being said, there's still like some phenomenal segments in there. And that's still a good movie. But a lot of that stuff just seems so random.
Oh, there's
no,
I think that's,
yeah, there's no,
that speaks to this like ongoing challenge of these 1 year projects. Cause we had these ideas and they were straight up half baked. Like there was never an opportunity to like fully figure anything out. And that summer in particular, I mean, we were talking about it earlier, just the fact that it was this massive undertaking to shoot all these intros in addition to doing all the editing that we had otherwise already signed up for.
Mm.
And it was just like, go, 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 go. Oh, yeah, we're going to try this. Hey, Decker, you're going to fly to Michigan and shoot Hornbeck sleepwalking, ripping off the Step Brothers intro. Oh, and then next weekend, Decker, can you go out to Hood and buy three handles of vodka and just get Ahmet and these dudes real wasted and just that'll be a Russia intro because of the vodka.
And then I flew to Utah. I went, drove down to Southern Utah with Wiley and Taylor and Guthrie.
Like a borderline racist.
Dude, straight up.
That is really hard. Really hard to watch now. I'm like, what were we thinking? What does this mean?
It's kind of tough.
You know, like, what does this mean? Like, there's so many horrible meanings you can pull away from that. And then, like, why? What's the point?
But yeah, the Wiley wore that headdress at every premiere that fall.
Really?
Yeah.
That does not help.
This is before the like Coachella appropriation got some backlash, but it was all.
And the other reason that a lot of that stuff didn't quite work too is because like only half the people in the movie really participated in that or put effort into it. So it was kind of like half the people would have these weird kooky intros and stuff, and the other people just have normal segs, and it was just kind of all over the place.
That was exactly my take, was that it just fucks with the pacing so hard, because sometimes there's a big extended intro and sometimes it's just like straight seg to seg, and it makes it all over the place.
And like the ants on the Before the Sun Valley thing, and I think that was supposed to be like the worker ants or like the people building the jump or,
right.
And then Ahmet has like a military,
very very political,
post-apocalyptic, super political. Like,
I mean the takeaway of that was that movie did not flow. We knew that, but we fully like made such a note of that. Like that was not lost on us. I mean, we were just talking about it earlier, but going into Sunny, we had to like right the ship there big time. It was like
which I think you guys did too.
We did, man. It was like Sunny was like the antidote to After Dark in a lot of ways. It was like, we need to make a movie
every
that
way.
Fucking flows. Like, because After Dark does not flow. We just knew that it didn't flow. We tried something, and, you know, good on us for trying shit, but.
Well, very literally, it was the antidote in the title as much as anything else, which, Parker, you and Chris came up with.
Yeah, I know. I remember that in Switch One. Yep. Slim! Hey! Off the bed. Are you kidding? Come on. Let's go. Sorry. Jesus. He did it right in front of me. Okay, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, I remember that in Switzerland. We stayed home that day and made that.
I think Wiley and I went out shooting, and then we got back, and you're like, yo, we got the title of the movie. We've got the song for the intro. Like, we got it all done for you. It's like perfect.
Yeah.
Sick.
Thanks, guys.
But back to After Dark, though. You know what? My two favorite segments from that movie, and one of them with an intro that I thought was just really cool and actually worked well, was Tanner Rainville.
Mm.
Yeah.
I liked that. I liked him swimming and all of his ski gear, and that was very dreamlike.
Well, that was what I was trying to do there. I think to kind of answer the question we've asked ourselves is like, what was our attempt to link all this together? I think everything had to do with dreaming and nighttime in some way, whether it's the dudes getting wasted on vodka and passing out.
Well, very literally. I mean, that's what the entire intro is.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think that's what we're trying to do, and whether or not like it definitely didn't succeed. But I mean, that was the theme that we were trying to link everything together with. But yeah, the Rainville thing, it was like trying to create this feeling where he's dreaming about POW skiing and likening it to like swimming and feeling weightless. Mm. But dude, we were shooting the intro to that in Athena's pool in Boulder.
Nice.
The Sunday night, so 6 days before actual premiere.
You got an ear infection or something, didn't you?
Yes, that's right.
Damn, good memory.
Damn, yeah. Yep. That was terrible. And just like shooting that thing so late into the edit season. And that was the other part of the problem. It's just like with the undertaking of all these ridiculous intros, I was telling these guys before, I didn't even watch the movie start to finish until the premiere. And of course, the premiere isn't really even the best environment to watch the movie in. And that is the first time that I've ever had to do that. And moreover, I mean, like, nothing was vetted. Like, we had no idea if the movie would flow, like, if there was any, like, if it was working or not working. And clearly there were things that were not working that were never going to be fixed or changed. But that was also the one and only time where we went back and reordered segments in the movie after the premiere.
Yeah, and I remember we made changes to my segment the day of or the day before the premiere because I flew into town to watch like the final version, and a bunch of stuff was changed around, and I was like, Berman, no way, dude. Like, I was like, all this is scrapped, and I remember being almost upset. I was like, there were shots of me like picking my nose and things like that. I was like, no, like that's not what I remember. But we changed all that like the same day. Like, I think that was the afternoon before the premiere.
Probably. It could have been like at the premiere.
Yeah, it was that day or the day before. And I just remember being so like, oh my gosh, what happened? And yeah, you have enough to think about the day of the premiere without like redoing someone's seg.
What was your second intro that you enjoyed?
It was not an intro, but just the seg. My two favorite segments were Tanner Rainville, and then that is DeLorme's maybe like best seg he's ever filmed.
It is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's like the standout kind of iconic Adam DeLorme segment to me.
Hello. Wait, what's the track? It's not Bad Mind.
Hello, Bad Mind.
Yeah, it is Bad Mind.
Good morning.
Yeah, it is Bad Mind. Dude, I mean, that was, I don't have like tons of memories necessarily from like the premiere and all that, but that was one of them was, how people fucking lost it to 80s part at the Cervantes premiere.
Well, it still holds. It's such an incredible part. You know?
Yeah.
I was like, I always try to walk around, and that was our second year at Cervantes, I think.
Yeah.
Which is just a rowdy ass spot in Denver. But
yeah.
Dude, I was like, I always try to walk around and get like different audience takes or whatever. And these kids were absolutely, there was like 14-year-olds smoking bowls in there, but there was like, dude, there was, these kids were, dude, I've never seen people so passionately lose it to like one part, because I saw them like watch another chunk of the movie, and then DeLorme shit came on, and every single thing was just like going ballistic for it. I was like, oh my god, this is like an iconic piece of work here.
Yeah, and it is,
dude. We had to move it around. That part I remember went off so hard at the premiere that we then moved the switched the order of it in the movie to like spice up like the end of the different movie. The end of the movie, basically.
We put it after that bastard Friends part. That's what we did.
Yeah. So that was song like, was my idea too. That was so bad.
Yeah, I know. You were like, dude. So you, I mean, I was talking about these guys, but you made like immediately quite a large impression on After Dark and Sunny. But After Dark obviously is what we're talking about. And in terms of the soundtrack for sure, because you just came in, dude. I just remember in Denver, you had like just a grip of music that had, I mean, that was immediately infused in the movie. And a lot of that was like switching over to like a vintage sound, like rock songs from the 60s and 70s.
Yeah.
And then an 80s rap song called Friends by Houdini. But you were like, dude, this shit goes, man. This is like pretty hilarious. And I think it was like in a semi-ironic way where I was like, this shit's funny. And we're like, yeah, dude, it is good. It is good for sure. Dude, let's use it.
Well, it's the chorus is Friends. So it's the Friends part. Fucking perfect. And poor Decker.
It's so literal and so happy.
Yeah. Oh, dude.
But dude, never ever in the history of Level 1 movies has a song been so vilified. Dude, like, people fucking hate, like, not like, nah, I'm not down with that. They, like, hated it. Outright hated it. To the point where, like, that ruined the movie. And I'm like, no. Dude, I don't, like, it's like, how can you hate the song that much? It's a kind of, it's a corny song, but it's like kind of, it's still like got this 80s shit. Just take, it's a funny song.
Yeah, whatever. Exactly. Like,
but so, yeah, people, just hated
people
it.
People hated that, and then they hated Goodbye Horses as well, which I think I had some influence
with. Oh, dude, I'll back that shit up, though. Yeah. Goodbye Horses is an absolute classic.
Yeah,
but, I'm not going to stand by Friends in the same way.
No.
I know if you don't like Goodbye Horses, that's like you have poor taste. And yeah, I'm sorry.
Thank you. That's what I was.
I don't think it was the song as much as just how that song had been used in film before and reusing it for the movie or something. I just remember that one. I remember getting a lot of criticism over Friends, rightfully so, and for whatever reason, people really didn't like Goodbye Horses as well.
But in general, I mean, there is a shift in soundtrack, I think, to, you know, based on your influence, musical taste or whatever, because, you know, if you look back on like previous movies, it was very
not that direction.
Hip hop,
De La Soul, and
I guess just like hip hop and dance hall and electronic or whatever. And that was like a shift, because, I mean, I very, very specifically recall being in Sun Valley when and Tim Lloyd was there, in fact, because you and Tim had been on a road trip, and you were like, this is the track I'm going to use for my After Dark part. And you played the Kinks' Dead End Street. And it, like, that song doesn't exactly slap, like, right off the top. You know, it's not like a traditional...
No, great segment song.
Though. Yeah, but it was so left field and unpredictable in terms of what you thought of as... We knew at the time you were going to have a big part in the movie. And so you're like, oh shit, like what's he got for a track? And you were like, this is it. You were like, you played it for us. And Tim was like, yeah, I love it. I absolutely love it. Like it has so many things that relate to you, your life. Like it's perfect in every way. Like you are Dead End Street.
Yeah, that's so funny.
That you're broke and nearly homeless.
Yeah.
But I just remember being like, it took a while for that to set in and kind of link. And I think it wasn't until you and Decker actually started editing it that it made sense. But I was like, can we like think of something that slaps a little harder? You know, that's like what. Because it was a very different choice than what we had been used to. So, yeah.
Yeah, totally. And that was definitely my shit. And I feel like I've almost every level one movie I've worked on, I feel like I've always offered a lot of music. Like even this year, we made that
straight up
huge playlist and stuff. And I think some of those tracks are getting used of kind of similar genre as well.
Yeah.
And some different things as well. Like that Brian Jonestown Massacre set, I always thought was good.
Partly Cloudy.
Yeah. Mm. It's been some good music.
Hell yeah.
So yesterday we recorded iTrip and talked for a fucking while about that Sun Valley jump session, just like how a lot of talk about how big the jump was, how seat of the pants the heli shit was, all of it. But wanted to get your take on your side of it, because your clips obviously are the standout shit from that seg. And
0 to 100 real quick.
Yeah, dude. What do you remember from that session?
I remember Berman being like, how big should we make the jump? And Chris and I being like, like as big as you can make it. Like he's like, what's too big? We're like, too big doesn't exist. Like, just, and he was like, what do you think? 100 feet or like 120, like just whatever. Just cause we had been just ripping Mammoth, dude. And even Mammoth at the time had like 90-foot tables open to public and stuff. So, and we would just train that. So at that time, Chris and I were really good at hitting jumps and just getting speed and whatever. So
comfort level was high.
Yes. Comfort level on big, big jumps. But yeah, I just remember hitting it and being like, oh, this is so smooth, but it's so extreme at the same time. Just remembering like, oh, this is all going to look so epic and so mental.
Sure did.
But yeah, and I remember too, the heli being a huge factor, dude, because now you just film all that with drones, or not that anyone's even really hitting stuff like that, but like you would get major wash from the heli and it would boost you like an extra 20 feet or something. So it was like
you're welcome.
Having a an actual heli following you, like, that's a huge element, you know? So I just remember the whole thing being so gnarly and so kind of extreme and being so gripped, but at the same time, it being so smooth and, like, accommodating and really sessionable. It's a sick jump.
Yeah, man. One for the books. They don't often make jumps that are that big and that much of a perfect match from takeoff to landing, and that's, like, yeah, just a testament to Pete Colombo.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, he crushed on that. But, yeah, that was psychotic. And cutting out the landing, it's like, oh, yeah, this wasn't gnarly enough. Saw the middle down, so you can literally fucking die if you miss where you're going. What? Well,
it's funny. I mean, you're talking about where they shear cut the backside, because when we hit it initially, you guys...
Shearing the backside, that too, but shearing the middle. Like,
oh, of course. Yeah.
It was a channel. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that was like an elemental part of the design, but I remember, like, it was still... At
least... Yeah, but it was your design and you weren't hitting it.
I know. No, I know. But at least, like, that existed from the get-go. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But the landing still rolled over, at least. So if, God forbid, like, you came up really short, you weren't just going to plummet to your death. Like, there was a survival opportunity there. Until they took it away. But I remember, like, that was part of the design. But I remember thinking, I'm probably having a conversation, at least with Decker, like, should we not shear cut that? And we were, like, talking about it and thinking about it. And then, like, the next morning, all of a sudden, the whole thing was just shear cut. And I was like, oh, well, never mind.
Yeah. And it does make it look so much more insane. Impressive and so much gnarlier. Realistically, though, like, if you landed where was sheer cut off, you'd still be in pretty big trouble.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
for
you
sure.
Just I mean, couldn't, just... you would have had to have, like, half the speed or something to even land there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does, like, it's more of a mental game, for sure, and it looks a lot more impressive, but realistically, it doesn't make hitting the jump any better.
No, of course not. But yeah, it's definitely, so much of that is a head game, though. I mean, that's... You know,
yeah.
You guys all have the ability at a certain at a certain extent to session something like that, but obviously there were only four dudes out of the crew of like a dozen that stepped to it.
And they had Dark to guinea that shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very imperative.
Dude, another funny thing from that era, the 2010 era, is like peak Skittles. Like many people, I mean, I remember kids directly throwing shade at us years like after that movie came out, but it was like, oh, this is like level one is like actual tropical Skittles. Like that movie iTrip is a bag of tropical Skittles. I know that joke was made in My Friend is a Pro too, but like that is like, there's so many colors going on, and you made a point going in. I mean, Tomahawk was affected that as well, but going into 2011 of just being like, fuck all that shit. We're going straight black.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Because one, that was all Tomahawk made, and that was my sponsor.
Yeah.
But two, because I didn't normally ski around wearing like yellow pants and bright clothing and things, you know. but that was, and you are fully to blame for that, Berman. You can take full responsibility.
Oh, not fully to blame, because you know what?
You are,
dude. That was an actual
requirement. You were like, you can't ski if you're wearing like dark clothing, like you, because you said like you just get lost in the trees, like you actually weren't allowed to not wear like really bright.
Okay, that's probably true to some extent, but I'll tell you what, watching that movie,
you made John Brogan cry because you said his baby blue tall tee was the same color as the sky and he couldn't shoot it.
When was that? Where was that?
In Mammoth.
No what? Way.
Oh my yeah. God. But anyway, hear me out, man. Watching that was a sign of the times, though. Like, I'm sorry, Brogan. I didn't realize I actually made him cry. But looking at all those other kits, like those Armada kits that everybody's wearing, Tom's kits, like, man, like that had nothing to do with me. And that was just full-on purple, yellow, Dayglo, orange, and red, all in one
Ronald
kit.
Ronald McDonald.
Like,
yeah.
Straight
up. What's that, guys? Slim. He's very friendly. Come here, buddy. Slim, come on. Let's go. Oh, load up. Slim, come on! Slim's harassing some passerbyers here. Come on, Slim! Sorry, guys. But yeah, no, that was definitely... Well, it's like what came first, the chicken or the egg, right? Because everyone was wearing that stuff in the movies, and then that's what all of the brands started to make, because that's what like people wanted to wear because the athletes were wearing it. in all the films. So that was like the hot shit. But also they were like, a lot of people were being forced to wear that because it shot well or whatever. I don't know. I think that you were to blame for that, Berman. I'm just going to
fine. Stick to your guns. I'll take some blame. Fine. I'll do it. And again, man, I feel bad. I didn't realize I made Brogan cry. That's so sad.
Yeah, well, if he's listening to this, I'm a good apology. But
sorry, John Brogan.
I think you were like, full disclaimer going into 2011. You're like, yeah, like if it doesn't work in your shot that I'm wearing black, like fucking find a different shot.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Which is legit, dude. Yeah. It's totally legit.
Yeah, I remember just being like, yeah, I'm not doing that anymore.
Well, and you know what? It worked out fine. It worked out absolutely fine.
Like, and then that was proof that you don't have to do that. Yep. So anyone years after that,
you taught me a lesson, you young buck.
Mm-hmm.
You're welcome. take credit for it. Or thank Jimbo, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you make appearances all throughout this movie, obviously, but let's talk a little bit about the opener individual seg to start it off. It has all park, backcountry, and street. What shot are you most proud of? What stands out the most to you watching that seg particularly again?
There's a couple shots. I really dig that huge backy I did in Cook City.
Mm.
Totally, man. That
was sick. And then there was like kind of a double pillow line that was right next to that. That was just special for me because I just remember I hadn't really hit a pillow or drops that big. That was my first year, like even really filming in the backcountry or hardly skiing backcountry at all,
Sure.
So I liked that double pillow line because I remember in my mind at the time thinking like, this, like, no one's hit something this big. Like, it wasn't that crazy, but.
Well, we were sitting on that one too, because you had hit it maybe like the first day we were there, crashed, and then we had to wait at least a week to get back to it. So,
yeah. And then I liked the opening shot of hitting that big cliff too.
Mm.
From that Telluride heli trip. But yeah, those were good shots. It was funny. Rewatching it today because I said this to Friedel on the phone already, but I remembered that as like such a pinnacle and kind of standout seg for me, but I haven't watched it in so long. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't even know the last time I watched After Dark, and like there's like some seriously mediocre sus, like a lot of heavy park footage in my segment, and like some
it's good really though, man.
Mediocre like, urban, and then my powder skiing, dude. I'm so stiff, like I just crunch up into this little cannonball and like hack turns or just don't turn in straight line. It's just so funny, you know.
I mean, I think a lot of people would kill to ski like that still, but I hear what you're saying. It's not how you ski now. Did you already know then, like, that backcountry was the future for you? Were you stoked on getting out there, and did you want to make that the shit, or what was the deal there?
I was kind of doing all of that because I wanted to film the most well-rounded segment that I could.
Hmm.
Like, to me, that was super important, that the seg just had every type of skiing in it.
Hmm.
And then the more that I obviously skied in the backcountry, the more I was like, yeah, this is all I really care about or want
to
do.
You don't want to go back to Edmonton?
No. I go back to Mall America and ride that roller coaster again. But
wait, were you in Minnesota too?
Or Mall of Canada, sorry.
Oh, I was like, how many street trips did you do? Because you just did one street trip, right?
I did Anchorage. Edmonton.
In this for this part. You went to Anchorage for Sunny.
No, I think I just did one street trip, and even all my POW footy, well, we did that one heli trip, but that was pretty much all that one Cook trip, which I was thinking about too, dude, and I didn't even have a snowmobile.
No, man, you, like, I was in down in Salt Lake with Wiley, and we invited you up on that trip, and you drove your Subaru from Mammoth to Salt Lake to meet up with us, and... Yeah. Wiley was like, dude, what the fuck? Why do you invite him? Like, he doesn't have a sled. And I was like,
which is totally valid.
Yeah. I mean, nowadays you'd be like, yeah, that's like a huge weakness, but it doesn't matter in that zone quite as much. And I knew that. I was very comfortable with it. I was like, I don't give a shit. He's coming, dude. He's going to kill it. And I'll double his ass. I was like, you don't have to do a damn thing. Don't even fucking worry about it. I was like, I'll double Parker around for whatever it takes because I want to see this kid ski this. And it paid off, dude. That was an amazing trip.
So, yeah. And thank you and thank DeLorme and Rainville for doubling me because that was huge. And to Wiley's credit, to Wiley's credit, like, if I were going on a trip next year and someone was coming on, they're like, yeah, he doesn't have a sled, Parker. I'd be like, cool, he's not coming on a trip. I'd just be like, that's mandatory, but yeah. To be nicer.
No.
That was very cool of you guys to have me along.
Well, I think going into the season, I mentioned this to Friedel earlier, like we didn't really have like traditional like pre-production meetings where we had like – we were making actual plans and really figuring shit out because it was really loose. But I do remember being in the office in the bedroom at Downing Street talking to Friedel. And we're just going over like a rough list of athletes and plans for the year. And Friedel's like, dude, Parker White is the coolest shit in skiing. And we're going to give him every fucking opportunity to do everything that we can get him on. Like, no questions asked. And it was like, all right, I'm on board for that. It's like... game on. And no, seriously, like that was a thing that, I mean, I felt it too, but Friedel put it into words and was just like, this is how it's going to be. And straight up, like everything we could do to give you an opportunity to do exactly what you wanted to do was like priority A1.
Yeah.
And
probably more so than other people joining in the past, maybe.
For sure.
Except for like Casabon, I felt that same way about. But I think with you in particular, not only do we have like super faith in your skiing and like wanted to take it in every direction possible, but we had just done the iTrip tour together. Remember that? We drove around like Montana and Idaho together. And I was like, dude, I just want to hang out with this kid a lot more. this dude's awesome. So it was like, this is the perfect combination to somebody that obviously fucks shit up. Like, he just did a zero over that gap jump in Sun Valley, but also like can clearly ski and is like mad fun to chill with. So
nice. Yeah, well, thank you very much, Friedel. I felt the same way, dude. I wanted to hang out with you all the time too, man. But dude, that was just peak. We don't have to go too far into that too, but I was thinking too, like that iTrip tour into After Dark, like that was peak debauchery, man.
Yeah,
please do.
Those trips we were on were just insane because it was just kind of like no parents, no rules. Let's go.
And I clearly wasn't on all those trips.
No,
what's up?
I clearly was not on all those trips.
Dad stayed home.
Dad stayed home.
But even like you were in, well, no, is it Decker in Edmonton with us?
Well,
different trips. We're talking about premier trips versus ski trips, but
even the ski trips, dude, like we were going hard on those trips. Like it was different times, man.
Yeah, let's talk about the Edmonton trip because that was your first trip of this filming season, right?
I think so.
Was probably let's say it was in January.
Yeah.
But I mean, what, that was Decker, yourself, Alex Belmar.
Yeah.
And
Compton. And Saya.
Were you there when Decker called up Compton to invite him on the trip? Or no, wait, what was? No, not invite him on the trip, but the news, the fake news thing?
Yeah, you got to remind me because you're like jogging my memory, but I still don't.
Oh, I thought you would help jog my memory. So Kyle is actually pretty damn good at pranks, but he called up Compton and basically said Compton was still in Vermont maybe or in Salt Lake City, one of the two places, but he was like had already been invited on this trip because Compton had done this trip with me and Will Wesson like back in like around Thanksgiving. So I was like, yo, like keep him in the mix. So Kyle invited him to the street trip to Edmonton. And then after he invited him, like a day later, then called up Compton from a blocked number or like a hidden number and was like, hi, this is like, Steve Smith from the Edmonton Sun. We heard that you're doing a level one production, has invited you on a street trip to Edmonton. We'd love to hear about it. It was some premise like that.
He recorded.
And he recorded it. And Compton was like, well, yes, that is exactly what's going on. He like put on this weird like reporter, talk to reporter like
interview voice.
And like got all serious and was like, yeah. And they're like, so, and Kyle, he didn't know Kyle at all. So he couldn't recognize his voice. And Kyle's like, so, can you tell me, like, about what you'll be doing here? Like, it's as if the fucking Edmonton newspaper is, like, actually gives a fuck that he...
Yeah.
The Compton, like, fully bought into it. It was like, yeah, we slide down rails and we do all this...
Super layman terms. Yeah, I'm really excited.
And then at the very end, dude, he's like... Dude, I'm just fucking doing that. This is Decker. Like, I just talked to you yesterday. Like,
I bet.
Oh my god, I never heard that. Does that exist somewhere?
I don't know if it exists, but it's something that's done. And man, he sees the opportunity and the perfect dude to do it with. Compton is like a perfect dude to.
Oh yeah, because he's so friendly and so congenial. He's like, oh wonderful, I'm doing a newspaper interview. No, you're not. So funny. Oh my god. Yeah. So my story from that was just that Alex Bellemare had never had Jack Daniels before.
Yeah.
Mm.
And so I was like, I got a bottle of Jack Daniels the first night. And he was like, whoa, like, this is so damn good, P. Like, what is this? I'm like, it's whiskey, man. But he and I would drink like a bottle of whiskey like every single night. And why mostly would you? Him.
Yeah.
And Seo would get like super mad at us for drinking so much every night because he doesn't drink or anything. So then it was like the last night, and he was super mad because his flashes weren't working, and we'd kind of been butting heads the whole trip and whatever. And he was really like anal about his bed, and so I was just sleeping on the floor. So he went down to like grab stuff out of his truck, and he was like, "Oh, you guys gonna get like." He's gonna be nice and drunk tonight, so you'll be all hungover skiing tomorrow. And we're like, yeah, probably, dude. Like, now and notice that's kind of what we do.
Yeah,
that's the program. Drinking
fucking trip with some skiing involved.
Yeah, yeah. And so he went down to like grab some stuff out of his car, and I just like laid down on his bed, which was like this couch. And he came back up, and he's like, "Get the fuck out of my bed, Dad!" I was like, dude, I'm drunk. Like, just go away. Just, I'm drunk. he fully went off the rocker. Like, I will punch you in the face. I was just fully freaking out. And I just was like, dude, I same thing. I woke up. I'm like, dude, I'm just messing with you. He's like, no, you're not. No, you're not messing with me.
Clearly, Seo did not know Parker White.
No,
not yet.
I was really pushing his buttons for sure.
But, yeah, he got trial by fire on that one. That's hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, and then the other thing I wanted to bring up, Friedel, was the plane crash in Cook City.
Oh yeah, well that's a whole nother. I mean that is a whole nother deal. But
I just read the NTSB report.
Yeah,
crazy brutal shit. Stuff.
The FAA is looking into it. It may have been staged. Yeah, I mean that involves something very different, but like, I mean, I guess we can go into like this filming at night stuff, like after dark.
Yeah, we haven't talked about that yet, so go for it.
I mean, it's not an entirely original concept by any means. The movie's called After Dark. We were going to film some sort of intro.
After Dark?
Get
no,
it?
No.
So
the
title
involved
of the movie
nighttime
is...
stuff. Not exactly like digging deep there in the. Creative department necessarily, but it was, I don't know, it was something that we wanted to do. So we were already doing it with Street, but we got the super smart idea that we were going to now film Powder and Backcountry at night as well. But
easy.
We were in
Cook City.
Yeah, that place. And
beep.
I mean, there was a good ass trip. I think we were crushing it in the day as well, but. That was when we started sledding out at night to try to set up some night features. And one of them was this mine that is kind of a non-normal sled zone tenure that we went up to that's like on this mountain above town. And Dude, I mean, the pill line you skied there was pretty rad for being, like, pretty blind.
Pretty legit, yeah.
Yeah, and Wiley, so it's basically this old mine shaft, like, bottomed out area on a pretty steep side of a mountain. But we're up there. We had shot, like, some stuff in the trees, and then we moved the, you know, we were sledding, towing sleds with generator and light kit into
floodlights.
At, like, 10 p.m., up there to shoot this. And then all this, you know, we're out on the main face. Wiley does like a backflip, Japan, I think. And then Parker skied the pill line. And we're pretty exposed. Like we're looking down on town and then we're, you know, we're lighting it up like for as minimal as possible. Like we're just firing up the generators and then getting the cameras like recording, and then you guys had one take pretty much. I think both of those were one take.
Yeah.
So we weren't like fucking around or dilly-dallying, but as long as those lights were on up there, way up on this mountain, some of the villagers below took notice. And this one lady basically like, I mean, it's a very small town. We're talking like 50 year-round residents. But she was like, oh, my gosh, like there's snowmobilers that are either stuck on the mountain or there's a plane has crashed into the goddamn plane has crashed into the mountain.
Well, I think she had like been in a plane crash and that was like what the rescue looked like or something like that. So she was all paranoid about it and been through it. She's like, a plane crashed into the mountain, like, so she called Forest Service.
Well, she called search and rescue, which I guess is the same thing. And, you know, this is at like 11 p.m. They started mobilizing to go see what was going on up on the mountain, like if people needed help. I think Wiley sledded down early. We were probably still up there packing up lights and generators. And he, like, this guy from search and rescue was down there, like, did you just come down from like the mine? Because is there like, are you safe? Like, is everything good?
Did you see the plane?
And he didn't want to like tell them like what we were doing because we were just kind of being secretive about it. And he was like, nothing, like nothing. It's nothing. We're fine.
No. You know what he said?
What?
He goes, I have the right to remain silent.
What?
Yeah, because it was like, he thought we were going to get arrested or something, and then he got all like professional and legal.
Decker
and
said
like,
that?
No,
Wiley. Because he was like, we were trying to just make sure everything was okay, but he didn't know if we were getting like busted or in trouble.
Like trespassing on this mine or something.
Yeah, he was
like,
he's like, I have the right to remain silent. And the guy was like,
clearly
what,
you were
dude?
Up to
like,
no good.
Dude, the guy was like, had just been probably woken up, you know, he's like the... And he was like, I just wanted to make sure everyone was all good up there. We thought maybe some snowmobilers were in or we heard maybe there was even like potentially a small aircraft had crashed into it. So he's like, yeah, we're all good. So it was fun, but it's like the talk of the town for the next week for sure.
Yeah, the whole, we'd be in the bar and everyone would like had made up different stories, like a total game of telephone, like, well, a bunch of ski doers got stuck and like search and rescue had to get them last night, or like a fucking plane crashed into Mount Republic, or all these things. We're like, yeah, not really, but
that would probably make more sense than what you were actually doing.
No,
so
that was true. Yeah, it did. And it's like, you just let that myth kind of create its own deal. We don't need to be like, well, actually, we're filming for an After Dark intro.
No. But it's just so funny. I have the right to remain silent. It's like the guy was probably like, what are you doing? Like, this is really bad. This is sketchy all of a sudden.
Yeah, like, you're making this way sketchier. Like, so what was the plane full of drugs? Like, what's going on?
Yeah, I just thought it was so funny.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But goddamn, I mean, what a extra, like a large amount of extra work that ultimately did pay off. Some of those shots were cool as hell, but we're out there
definitely
all day and then coming back for dinner, and then maybe having a beer or two, and then going back out and then hauling generators, gas, and lights to set up more shots that are way harder to get, especially for you guys. Dude, that tree you hit that ends out the intro, that like burned tree.
Crash.
That was kind of gnarly.
I know. I remember being really angry about that. That like really hurt.
Yeah, that, I mean, goddamn. There's some other stuff. Berman, you shot some night POW as well.
I did. So that whole undertaking was, we bit off way more than we could chew. That's,
well, we chewed some stuff.
But. Well, okay, fair enough, fair enough. But it was just a much greater undertaking than I think anybody quite realized as far as what we were signing up for. And my first foray into it, I think it was probably a couple weeks before you guys got busy in Montana. I was up in working with one of the cat operations. I think it was Monashie Powell with DeLorme and Rainville and who else?
Bibby?
Yeah, it was actually Bibby. Yep, that was the third. But conditions were really good. And obviously when you're at a cat op, you're even at a discounted media rate or whatever, you're still paying a little bit of a premium to be up there and working with the guides and the operations. So we are putting in long days, like as long as we possibly can, because it's so good. And you're not going to stop anybody from either shredding or shooting POW in that kind of environment. And I put off doing the nighttime thing as long as I possibly could. And like one of the last couple nights we were there, everybody's exhausted and just beat up, but it was just nuking snow. And it's like, all right, I'm going to fucking do this right now. And we wrapped up our day and I never even like took my boots off. I think it was like 6 a.m. until like 2 a.m., 3 a.m., something like that. Everybody else went back and had one of those awesome cat op dinners. And
yeah.
I just rallied right out with towing a big toboggan full of a couple generators and all these lights. And I mean, it was just like bottomless POW. And I'm trying to like huff all this gear up into position and trying to figure out like lining up these shots. I mean, especially, you know, when you don't have a specific feature in mind, it's just kind of like rolling POW fields. You're trying to figure out where to put these lights. And anyway, it definitely worked out, but like pound for pound, those were some of the most hard earned shots that I'd ever gotten at that point in my life. And, you know, a couple of the Rainville ones turned out really well. I think AD had
yeah, Rainville
few of them.
Has some sick ones.
Yeah, but holy shit, that was something. And like I didn't want to make it tough on the guys because, you know, they were beat and this is like my like asking for favors basically. Because everybody knew that this was not for their part. This was just like going to be in some like stylized intro. So of course, like the interest level,
very faceless in the clips. Oh, like yeah. You got no idea who's skiing sure. unless you really know what's going on.
The interest and participation is minimal
it's
at best.
Pro bono.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
So again, like I'm just getting everything dialed and then I like rally, you know, a mile or two back to the lodge to get these guys. I'm like, all right, it's ready. Let's go do this. I know it's 11 o'clock at night, but let's go shoot more POW. And yeah, I mean, that was just like a small taste of like what became of some of these other intro shoots. I mean, even the more controlled environments like the park shoots, Parker, which you were around for as well.
Yeah, the Breckenridge one and stuff.
The Breckenridge one. And then, of course, the Sun Valley one, like that yeah, wall, with the ride wall ride feature where we're working smoke machines into the mix, which was just like another factor entirely where.
Yeah, what were we doing?
Crazy shit. But actually, like the Breckenridge one, I'm glad you brought that up. If you remember, it was May 1st and there was a freak late season blizzard. It was just nuking on us.
And yeah.
That was the night all of a sudden phones start blowing up. They got Osama bin Laden.
Really?
Yes. That was the night. In fact, like that's how I remembered it. And I had to look it up earlier today just to make sure I wasn't imagining something. But straight up, that's when the news broke because they actually got
that's
him.
That's bizarre. I did not remember that at all.
They got him at 1 a.m. on May 2nd, and obviously that's...
It was actually 0:30 is when they got him.
Yeah.
All right, Friedel.
Do you think that Come we had now. Something to do with that in some weird way?
That we did? Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean,
Osama bin Laden's capture?
After dark 30, yes. I'm seeing it.
After zero dark thirty.
Yeah. Oh my god. Yeah. What a random little tidbit of information.
Oh, dude. I remember feeling like people were hyped. Like people were just like cheering all over the place.
It was Marilyn Manson's birthday, and Osama bin Laden got captured. What?
The funny thing
is, we were skiing.
I remember. I remember where I was too that night. I was at like Blavelt's house with Wiley. We were driving back from Whistler. It was like late at night at some party, and like. Yeah, Washington, Bellingham or something. But I don't know why. That's one of those events. Also, like,
yeah.
You know, when JFK got shot or something.
Sure.
Yeah.
Or
you remember that too, Friedel?
9/11. Yeah. No, I was a star in the sky. I think there was a new moon.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Japan trip from this year.
Parker's first trip to Japan.
Yeah, that was sick. I can't believe I waited as long as I did to go back, actually, just this year.
Yeah, no doubt, huh?
Yeah, but it was, that was such a fun trip. That was also like my first POW trip ever.
Damn.
Like, I'd skied a bit of POW with like the Montage dudes in Sonora, but that was my first full-on like skiing POW trip.
That's a pretty good one.
yeah, no kidding, huh? And it's like, I think that was a bit of a test for me too, to see if I could ski POW and stuff, because it's like pretty, it's friendly enough over there, you know?
Mm.
And it's all like lift access or hike. So I think that was maybe, correct me if I'm wrong here, Berman, your way of testing me, like, okay, can he ski powder? Can we get
No. I think at that point, it was pretty safe to say that we had full confidence, and it was just a question of rallying a crew. I think part of the crew design there was that Jimbo Morgan got involved with this trip because he wanted to go on a trip to Japan. And he's like, Berman, yeah, let's put this together. Because he was managing you guys for Skull Candy and Electric at the time, which was also the connection with Rainville. And Rainville, obviously, best POW skier in the world. So he was going to be on this trip. And Jimbo saw this as a vacation slash there's some weird miscommunication where he thought he might be filming for his part. And I don't know if you remember that situation.
Yeah. Well, I thought, yeah, my side of the story was that you wanted to film like a legend status seg or something, or include Jimbo in some way as like the like old time, bringing him back, getting shots for the seg.
Yeah, but I think from my perspective, it was like I had talked with him about doing some kind of cool retrospective. So a little bit more about Jimbo Morgan really quick. I mean, he is straight up a legend in the sport to some extent. He at one point held the world speed record for going, it was like 159 miles an hour in Les Arcs, France. And I mean, he's super accomplished, you know, former US team racer, just like all around badass. And I actually remember the shop that I worked at in New York growing up, Hickory and Tweed, they had a big poster of Jimbo Morgan on the wall. So straight up, oh yeah, I mean, I knew who Jimbo was from way back in the day. And yeah, I think at that point, you know, following in the footsteps of what we did at Sun Valley, like I thought that there were some cool stories to be told. And it's like, man, Jimbo has a story to be told. Like, it'd be awesome to figure out a way to tell that at some point. For me, that was not in the context of bringing Jimbo to Japan so much. But I think some signals got crossed. Jimbo definitely thought he was there filming for a Jimbo part, which is a very weird dynamic, to be honest. But anyway, yeah, it was an awesome all-around trip. And I think if you remember, Parker, taking a ride on the gondola down the mountain before,
before the resort
put a stop to it.
Yeah, I think I'd seen that somewhere. That was so much fun. I would do that again.
I saw that at Barstool Sports.
Dude.
Yeah. Was that crazy? What? But yeah, that was, I don't know much what to talk about with that trip, but that was a really, really fun trip. Yeah, it was like my first POW skiing trip ever.
Well, I mean, when we went back, so we went back this January 2019, and you, that was your first time back since for 8 years.
And yeah.
I think you were like, oh, I feel like I'm like experiencing it again for the first time, because you just didn't really get the cultural intake or whatever it was.
No, I was so young, and like we were staying at what was that lodge there, the Black Diamond Lodge. Yep. And I would order like a Philly cheesesteak sandwich every night.
Yep.
And then have cereal for breakfast every day or whatever. I was like, oh, I'm in Japan. Whatever. And I was only 19, and I could not have even pointed on a map where I was or anything.
Right.
You know? Like, yeah. So yeah, and now, and even like in backcountry zones and stuff, all that stuff was so sort of catered to at the time that I was just along for the ride, and I was like, oh yeah, whatever, I'm in this place now, cool. But I never looked into any of it for myself. So now, obviously, when I go places, I'm like a bit more involved and attentive with that. But
the other thing that I recall very vividly about that trip, if you remember, we were involved in that sketchy slide and semi-burial situation with myself and Tim. So to this day, and knock on wood, somewhere in this room, that was and is the sketchiest situation that I've ever been involved with. And unfortunately, it really wasn't that bad, but I mean, it was an easy way to learn a lesson for sure.
Mm. So, yeah, we were being stupid.
I mean, you can chime in with your feedback or your memories of it for sure. But from what I recall, we were in resort boundary, just kind of like not even side country, but like definitely lift access, just traversing within the resort. And there's this south facing pitch that I'd actually remembered shooting a couple years before on another trip. And it was really just like, you know, some of the shorter, steeper pitch terrain, which there is not a lot of over there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, south facing, when the sun comes out, things get baked so fast. And I think that was the case a couple of days before. And then there's one of these crazy storm cycles where all of a sudden it's dumping, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 feet of snow in like a 24-hour period. And then we show up and it's like, oh, this is good. And it was really deep, really light. But everything was moving. And I remember we just did one run on this pitch and everything is fracturing. And it was like,
yeah,
no doubt, like every time somebody drops in, something is going to start going. But from my perspective, like I don't take any of that stuff lightly. Not that I'm a snow safety expert by any means, but I certainly had enough experience to know what was right and what was wrong. And I knew what I thought I knew was going to happen, but I also thought it was going to be manageable. And that was the one mistake that we made, was thinking that, you know, the smaller pitch was going to slide and it wasn't going to move as big and as fast as it actually did.
Well, you get caught off guard in Japan because there's never anything that you feel in Hokkaido anyway, like the North
Island. It seems so approachable.
It's very...
Yeah, the terrain is so friendly.
But
yeah.
You forget, well, it's, I can't say it's you forget, but it's easy to let your guard down because there's nothing ever super menacing or obvious that's like, this is going to be dangerous.
No, but yeah, that's a crazy mistake that the people make. And I know a few years prior, and I don't know the story behind it, but Ben Mullen, who was one of the principal cinematographers for Poor Boys at the time, was involved in what sounded like a similar situation. And he actually had a pretty serious head injury because he was involved in something very similar in the trees, where that's where it gets sketchy, is because you know, there are often the tightly spaced trees that often like hold snow together don't necessarily do it there. Mm-hmm. And it provides a little bit of a hazard. But in this case, so I think you had already skied your line and you were kind of hanging out, if I recall, in the same area as Tim and I, Tim Lloyd, the photographer.
So I skied a line. I was just hanging with you guys shooting at the bottom. And then Wiley skied a line and Wiley popped off a slide and the slide came all the way down the slope and then through the flat bottom in the trees that we were in filming from, like Barbie angle.
Mm.
And then it like pushed me off my feet, but I just had my skis on and I stayed on top and everyone was like screaming. It was crazy. And then, Berman, you were like up to your waist and you were fine. I was like, where's Tim? Where's Tim? And I looked next to me in the snow and I just saw the tip of Tim's hat. And I just reached my hand and scooped all the snow and I just unburied Tim's face. But Tim was fully buried.
Jesus.
Like, but he was, and I reached down and scooped his face out and he was all good to go. And then I went to go move myself and I couldn't, like I was cemented in like up to my waist. And I just so luckily was
So you had
right
done
next
that,
to Tim.
You didn't even take a step. You just leaned over.
No, I saw the tip of his hat, leaned over and just dug his face out and like, he was good, and I was like, holy shit. And then I went to move myself, and I couldn't move.
Yeah, it had set up.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was really scary. It was like this really small slope, and it seemed like whatever. And then afterwards, yeah, it was just really scary, and we were standing in a really stupid place. So that was that was sketchy. I totally forgot about that, actually.
Super sketch. I mean, from my
perspective.
It's
like the only avalanche I've ever been in, actually.
Yeah, from my perspective, I remember, you know, again, we knew that everything was fracturing and moving, but I thought we were fine. And I've got my skis on my feet.
Shit looks innocuous. You just got to be careful of where people are.
For sure. But yeah, I was standing next to you guys and I've got my skis on similar to you. I'm facing directly uphill. And I remember Wiley drops in looking through my camera. I've kind of got tunnel vision and Wiley just kind of dips out, cuts hard left. And I remember thinking at the time, like, oh man, you just blew it. Why did you cut out? You know, the first half of that shot looks so good. And then I'm slowly just moving the camera down and there's like a twig or a sapling, small tree. And all of a sudden it just starts waving violently. And I remember just doing a double take and thinking like, huh. And like 2 seconds later, I just get blasted, like my entire body. It felt like I was hit by a running back, but it was this weird even pressure across my entire body. So I didn't fall over backwards. I just slid really fucking fast backwards through the trees, still just like frozen in place, like holding my camera, looking through the viewfinder, just like dumbfounded by what was going on. And then as soon as I came to a stop, I was probably similarly to you, just like buried in cement, like
up
waist
to your
deep.
Waist or something.
Yeah. And I think it took us like a solid hour to find Tim's snowboard and my camera pack.
Yeah. Damn. Anyways, that was pretty nuts.
Super gnarly for your first ever like backcountry pow shit, dude. Like trial by fucking fire going on there.
Yeah, but I think that I was just kind of young and stupid too, and I was like, "Oh yeah, that was crazy. Like, we're good." I don't think that anything really sunk in or affected me, or certainly that I didn't learn anything at that age. I was just like, "Oh,
fair enough."
Right. Yeah. I wonder if Tim Lloyd is listening.
I hope Tim Lloyd.
I don't think we properly introduced him because I was doing my pretty terrible British accent, but a while back, Tim Lloyd's a photographer from the UK. That spent actually a lot of time with us those years.
Well, in there, if I remember correctly, he spoke Japanese, and he was friends with our buddy Tatsuya, and that's how we first connected. Oh, am I right?
I have no idea.
I have no idea if Tim speaks Japanese.
I really hope I'm not making that up, because that's pretty far out.
He doesn't look like he speaks Japanese. I did never think that about him.
No, wait. I swear to God, he definitely speaks Japanese.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. And that was the connection.
The Queen's English.
That as well.
Yeah. Very properly.
Yeah. Tim, if you're Swiss as well.
Tim, if you're listening, let us know if Berman's got that one right, because no one else does. Any while we're talking about Japan, anything fun from this year outside of the skiing, obviously, that you guys want to share? Stories from being there with Lucas?
From this year?
Yeah.
I mean, it was kind of a dream crew, because actually Parker, it was a full circle type deal, because Parker is single-handedly responsible for even bringing Lucas into the fold in a roundabout way in 2012.
Really?
Super unknown. Yeah, so we were up in Whistler that whole March and April, or most of March and April, filming for Sunny.
Mm-hmm.
And we got sent all of the Super Unknown videos, and they had been already sort of sorted out or whatever for finalists.
Yeah.
But we were watching them. P-White is just like, I just remember sitting on the couch, and you're like, dude, what this? Is this kid in the finals? And I was like, nope. Yeah. And then you're like, well, that's a huge problem.
Yeah.
I think at that point, the finalists had already been released. And so this dude, Lucas, had been listed as a semifinalist. And it was like out and about that these are the semifinalists. These are the finalists.
And so that corrective measures had to be taken?
Dude, well, I mean, it's kind of fortuitous that we were even watching the scraps.
Yeah.
Because I think for whatever reason, maybe we were like kind of out of the loop, and I didn't really know if we still can like vote for the finalists or whatever. Mm-hmm. But these guys were on a different level, like they already picked them.
Yeah.
Well, but, one quick note here, because I need to tell the full story. I mean, this was 2012. Spring of 2012, right?
Yeah.
This was the first year that I had completely handed over the reins to the first and only year since, of course, that I've ever handed over the reins to the initial video sorting to somebody else who will remain nameless. But
it was Chewy.
No, it was not Chewy. It was not
what?
Chewy. Yep, somebody else.
Chewy.
I thought it was too.
No.
I have no idea, though.
No.
I wasn't there.
It was a dude who was Chewy right now.
Well, no, Chewy was involved in the conversation, I think, too, at some point.
Chewy, but you get your cred back, son.
Yeah, but no, it was somebody who was doing shipping and receiving stuff for us, and they expressed a big interest in getting involved, and it was like, well, fuck, I'm so busy. Can you please watch these 100 videos?
Yeah.
Which I will say is a mind-numbing task.
It's fucked.
And if you don't make a very concerted effort to like watch them several times over and like.
Dude, it's hard enough just to watch all the semis when they come out. Like, as a fan, I don't do that shit. Like, it's there's a lot of fucking content there.
It's nuts.
Friedel and I, one time in Bellingham in a Motel 6, watched every single video, every single Super Unknown video together, and we rated them 1 to 10.
Yeah.
Every single one. It took us, like, hours.
Yeah.
And then we'd have to go back and regrade people, and our guy was, like, a -4. And I was like, okay, this guy's, like, a 7.
Because you start your scale high or low.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
We've done that. But yeah, well, I saw the semifinalist video and I was like, holy shit. I was like, this guy should win. Like, this is the winning, because I'd watched all of them and I was like, this is the winning video.
Yeah, that's what it was. Okay, yeah, so these were
these were already the selects that were promoted online.
Yeah,
and I'd seen, and I probably saw all the finalists too for you guys, but I was like, oh, this is, like, this guy wins. Like, why wasn't he in the mix? And then the reason I thought it was Shuey, because Shuey told me, he's like, oh, I didn't put him in the finals because he didn't really show a lot of his landings. And I was like, And that's a funny thing about Lucas too, is he can't land. A lot of people don't know that.
If you go back and watch his parts in level one, we never show a landing.
Yeah. But no, it was like, yeah, he didn't show any landings and we thought that was weird. So like, we didn't put him in. I was like, that was the best video. So you guys messed up. But then everyone else watched it and it was kind of all the general consensus. And then he won that year.
Yeah. I mean, that was something that we never did before or since. It was this complete and utter curveball where all of a sudden, like, so a little bit more background for those that are unfamiliar with Super Unknown at that point, this is before it was a live event. Where we'd effectively take these, you know, roughly 100 entries, watch them all start to finish, put them in some sort of rough order, release, I don't know, somewhere between 10 and 15 what we called semifinalists, which were effectively honorable mentions, and just let them sit online and give them a little bit of a shout out, and then do the same with 10 finalists. And then we all had an idea of who we wanted to be, you know, who were the cream of the crop for sure, but then we'd kind of read what people are saying online. We'd talk to all the athletes and sort of take a poll within the crew as far as like who should actually win. Mm. And that's where you enter Parker White. You're like, y'all fucked up. Yeah. That kid in semis, he's got to win. And it was like, well, you know what? Like, you got something there. You really do. And I remember making the announcements like, surprise, semifinalist won. And there's a huge uproar. Everybody's like, fuck you guys.
Yeah, I'm sure all the finalists were not too stoked. Yeah, but history has borne that decision out for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We can make our own rules. No, it's our contest.
No looking back on that one. But we ended up going on a trip together in 2013 in France. He joined myself, Parker, and Chris Logan. And which is actually funny because he like sent us an email being like, yeah, because I don't think he thought that we respected him in like a power ride in backcountry type way, talking about vetting people for a backcountry trip. But he's like, yeah, I placed like 14th in a big mountain contest in Sweden. Yeah, yeah. And we're like, dude.
You're in. Perfect.
I could send us a photo of your like report card and also just height and weight and we'll see if you're okay or not.
Dude,
maybe even a trick list. Yeah, send us your trick list.
Lucas, I was on the fence about inviting you, but when I saw that comp result,
he on that trip like hadn't really skied POW yet.
Nope.
That was kind of his first POW trip was skiing.
He had skied
in France.
Like the
Sweden POW,
yeah. Some yeah. Like, but that was a different.
Put your pants back on, please.
But I mean, yeah, Parker, I'm sure you
were you sitting in the bathroom that whole time?
Yeah. My bathroom, bedroom, same thing right now.
So it goes.
Yeah.
But I mean, Lucas had skipped out on a few years of filming his level one, and then it was a year and a half ago now at Kimbo Sessions in 2018, Parker and I were invited over there filming for Zigzag and started talking with Lucas, and I don't know, the idea came up. It was pretty natural. He's like, yeah, I'd love to do we were talking about Japan, and we're like, well, let's go to Japan next January for the Level 1 20th movie. It'll be you, Parker, and I. And then Casey Dean actually ended up joining us for a little bit of it, but it was
Casey Dean was there for a bunch of it.
Well, kind of. I don't know. From my perspective, I stayed quite a bit longer than Casey.
But. Yeah, true. But then, like Lucas had been there the year before too, so he had like a big hit list and shit that he wanted to get done, which he very, very much so did. Like what I think from this year, you told me that Lucas had 16 minutes of raw footage just from Japan.
Yes.
That's incredible. That's incredible.
This is pretty fucked up. Even for a month of filming, like that is a lot.
That wasn't even
in
slow mo. That was all playback real time.
Some of the, I think that some was
slow mo. To put that in perspective, I had 1 minute and 56 seconds of raw footage from the entire year this year.
Boom. And that was all in super slow mo. So technically, it was only three shots.
We really want to show those grabs.
That's cool to hear. I never knew that backstory, damn. There's obviously Sun Valley round two in this movie with another Giganto jump sesh and more CeeLo goodies. I don't know if you have thoughts on his part, but it's a fucking good one. Obviously, his rookie year, strict, you know, from a real sense, his rookie year in the crew. And one of the Sun Valley features really sticks out. It's like a fucking double rail transfer with a whale tail in the middle, and he fucks up that thing.
Double what?
It's
like a whale tail, like rail to like a dish to like a jump to another rail.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's like a Tony Hawk Pro Skater line.
Yeah, exactly. It's so ridiculous looking.
Yeah, he does like the 450 on like line two out.
Yeah,
that was sick. You know what shot I really liked of Darkness's from that is the opening, just like. It's essentially like a Sev Japan, but he hits that cannon rail to the hip landing. So gnarly. Yeah, dude, Chris tore it down that year. And I think the only reason that he had a split seg is because he was still trying to compete a bit. So I got in with level one the year before with iTrip and then was full on like, yeah, this is my only obligation and priority is just to film. And he was filming, but he was like going to do tour stops, and he just filmed like a little bit less that year. So that's why he had the split seg with Alex Bellmare. But he, dude, like the 10 blunt. He had a bunch of super sick gnarly shots.
Guardsman's Pass. That was actually, I believe, the first time that I had ever really shot with him on a like one-on-one sort of situation. And I remember he got right Sev and then 10 cork 10 blunt on that thing, and I remember thinking, all right, this kid is definitely the real deal. No joke. Not that there was any real doubt in my mind, but you never know. You don't know until you go.
Those things certainly fucking drive the nail home.
Yep. Yep.
They're very affirming, like, oh my god.
Yeah, not that he didn't fully tear down the iTrip like Sun Valley session.
No, for sure, but this was a situation where it was
filming
backcountry. Exactly. And I mean that definitely throws a wrench in the gears for some people without that experience.
Yeah, there are definitely question marks or whatever, but
yeah, I think that. And Chris was hitting some street and stuff that year too. I don't think he was, but
I mean, yeah, you guys were a package deal basically from day one. It was kind of like there was never like, I don't know.
Oh yeah. Well, that was all through Jimbo too, because the first time we came and shot with you guys was Refresh year,
right?
And it was like, and I don't blame you guys for doing this too, because he was like, you guys got to have these two random kids like come sesh your jump, and the crew was already so big, and you guys were like, yeah, no, we don't know them, and we're not doing this, and
we Berman, couldn't laugh
told
people.
Us.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing, is that we had to get a fucking snowcat to tow 27 dudes up at once.
Yeah, and you told us we could come hit the jump if we could come up with two snowmobiles to help tow the crew. And then we're like, and we didn't have sleds, so we're asking Bernie, and we're like, come on, dude, like, we can film with level one if you just give us your snowmobile. And he's like, fuck you. Like, I'm not doubling a bunch of people. Like in spring, I'm going to blow up my sled for you guys. Like, what are you talking about? So I forget. I think we just showed up anyways, and like DM and a bunch of dudes were there, and then you guys were like, okay. And then we just all hit it, and it was no problem. But I remember it was like a big fiasco. It was like the day before we're shooting, and you're like, can you guys get two sleds? And we're like, oh my gosh. We're like, come on, guys. We need two snowmobiles. And we have in, man. We're going to shoot.
We need two snowmobiles. 54 perfectly ripe avocados.
Yeah, exactly. Like, some Cambodian breast milk. But But yeah, that was like the deal for us to come shoot, and then we didn't do it, and we got to come shoot anyways.
Yeah, so. Well.
Yeah. Yeah, that was funny.
No hard feelings. I mean, you can imagine what a junk show would be if like every single person that ever asked to come shoot or come hang at a park shoot in particular gave a green light to it. Just be like a obscene.
Well, that's the thing that's like a behind the scenes logistic thing that you don't think about, but getting 15 people laps on a jump is no small task. And we thought we were going to have these sleds, but I think when the day of Mammoth is like, oh, you can lap with a cat. So that answered the question, but I want to skip ahead to the premiere situation because I think that the After Dark premiere is fairly legendary, if I'm not mistaken.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Catfish Whiskers.
Yeah, did you get involved with the...
We're throwing some curveballs at you, Connor.
Yeah. It kind of said...
Oh, you don't know about Catfish Whiskers?
I do not. You dude, fill me in,
one,
please.
Level one history.
That's her nickname for you, dude.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, well, dude, I forget how it even happened, but Chris got in a fight with one of the bouncers. Okay. And with Cervantes, it's probably pretty standard.
Mm-hmm.
But, dude, he got in a fight with, like, one of the bouncers, and then all of a sudden he had, like, 10 bouncers on him. Like 10 dudes, and Chris was holding his own pretty well. And then Liam and I jumped in, and we weren't even really fighting. We're just like pulling guys off of Chris because he was on the ground at that point. So we pulled like all of the bouncers off of Chris and then got him outside. And whatever, we all got kicked out. And we're like, okay, Chris, like we can sneak back in through the back, but like you gotta be cool.
You gotta hold it down.
Not stir the pot. And he's like, and the guy Catfish Whiskers, dude, he threw this punch that was like, I've never seen a punch like that. It was like his arm was like a bullwhip almost, and it just cracked on Chris's face so perfect. I was like, holy shit. And he cracked Chris so good. But anyways, we go out and Chris is like, I'm gonna like get that guy. No, Chris, we're not, this is done. And then we went back in. We just snuck back in through the back to the back bouncer who wasn't involved. We're like, we're in the movie, dude. Like, we you got a message? And he's like, oh, yeah, come back in. Chris had just fought all the other bouncers. And then we got back in. We just, like, partied all night. It was all good.
So that place, Cervantes, was our world premiere venue here in Denver for a few years. Once we outgrew the Bluebird Theater, which was on Colfax. And so Cervantes is this historic jazz venue here. I remember... like we were in a pinch just because we didn't have the budget for any of like the real big time legit venues. And somebody mentioned something about Cervantes. I remember, Friedel, were you there for our like first tour of that place when we met these guys?
I wasn't, but heard it was funny. There was some kind of like mattress.
Man. So a couple of things. I mean, this place was independently owned, unlike a lot of the concert venues in most major cities. And these guys were young and super loose with their operation. And first off, when we show up, they said, you can do anything you want in this venue as long as you don't bring a gun. That was the one red line rule. And they're giving us
Chris brought a gun that night. I know.
Well, that's why they kicked him out, man. He broke the only rule.
He had a gun. It was the one rule.
Damn it, CeeLo. And then this was in the summer that we were touring it. It was right after Gay Pride Week, and there was some kind of event at the venue the week before, and I remember they're showing us the balcony and there was a mattress on the floor and you're like, don't go near that thing. It's like, oh my god. And then the night of the green room in the back where they like, you know, gave us the keys and like toured us around, they're like, oh, here's your green room, and they put like a big mirror on the table in the green room. It's like, oh my god. Like, you guys think this is a slightly different party than it actually is, but that place was so loose. It was more of a party than a ski movie premiere.
Yeah, particularly those years. I tripped After Dark.
But you know what else happened that year? So they had STS9, Soundtrack Sector 9, used to do their Red Rock shows that same weekend, and the owners of the venue had a relationship with a dude who did all the lighting design for STS9. And so after the Red Rock show, just in time for what became our after party, this dude would show up at the venue and do the fucking craziest like light shows.
You were having a rave
pretty much
at the premiere.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Damn.
And Derek Finn, DJ Ecto Cooler, showed up to DJ and like.
Sick.
We gonna have the light show for Parker's funeral this year?
I'm gonna bring a flashlight, maybe light some candles.
Yeah, we could have the fog machine. That would be pretty awesome.
That's coming out.
Use for the After Dark intros. Yeah, what were the other really good stops from that?
From After Dark?
Yeah, that
we had a Salt bunch. Lake for sure.
Yeah.
Wow, I'm blanking out pretty hard, but
Chris and I got a gun pulled at us at that Sun Valley shoot. You remember that?
What?
What?
At the shoot during the year you're talking about?
Yeah.
By who?
This guy at a party.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. I vaguely remember.
What had you done to promote this?
Dude, it's some Idaho house party shit.
Yeah, we got invited to this eviction party.
That's right.
And the guy was like, the whole theme of the party was like, tear the house down because we're getting evicted. So Chris and I were doing such. And then at some point, the guy decided he didn't want to have an eviction party anymore.
Mm. You can't about face on that one.
Yeah, you can't go back. So Chris and I were just like, yeah, buddy, like, I don't think so. Like, this thing's pretty full swing. and then we were like hitting our heads through this drywall. We like,
I was there for that. Oh my God.
We broke this big hole into this guy's bedroom. And then it was like after he tried to end it and we were just laughing and partying. And then this like barrel of like a hunting rifle, like stuck right into me through the hole in the wall. And we like, this dude fully pulled a gun on us and he was like all wavering, super drunk. And his friends were like, whoa. and just grabbed it from him. But yeah, it was pretty insane. Yeah.
Oh, Jesus Christ,
man.
That was a pretty good one.
So I'm just going to backtrack a little bit. Cause I meant to tell this story last week and we never got around to it. And this particular athlete will remain nameless for now. But, Parker, if you remember the year before in Sun Valley, somebody in the crew like to get a little whiskey drunk and got into it at a bar with a local after the shoot.
I don't know if Parker was there for that.
I don't even remember.
He was underage.
Oh, that's right. Well, we were there for the aftermath. You might remember it.
Pretty much just me and like two other people maybe dealing with that shit.
Do you want to tell the story?
No.
No? Okay.
Well, it's just dumbassery.
Yeah.
Drunkenness.
Well, anyway, so this dude ends up like just getting into it with a local and nothing actually happens. I think like they swung and missed and fell and landed on their face in the parking lot, split their face open, which was all fine and dandy until a few days later when it got infected and their face was so full of fluid and swollen up that they could barely see and they were barely recognizable. It was like a couple years after Avatar, the movie came out. And I remember straight up thinking like, this dude looks like he's from the movie. And I didn't take a picture because I felt for one, so bad for this person. I also thought it might be like super serious. And it's like, oh God, like they've got to go to the hospital ASAP. And I think they got on a bunch of antibiotics and had their face drained and ended up being okay. But
yeah, there's all kinds of crazy stuff that happens through all the years.
Yeah.
So we're no longer allowed there.
Yeah. There's too much drinking, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Too much fun.
Yeah. Some of it was fun, I guess. The rest of it's just crazy.
Yeah. Fear and loathing in Sun Valley. Dude.
Yeah, pretty much.
Catch them.
Yeah. Yeah, they thought they'd seen it all in the 70s, and we're like, hey, yo.
Yeah, for real. Like, it's back, baby. Did you miss us?
Yeah, Sun Valley's like, that was old us. Like, you guys aren't allowed to come back here.
We've changed.
It's only rich people now.
Yeah, exactly.
Sick. Well, probably a time for final thoughts, if anybody has any. Parker, you got any lasting impressions from this movie or stories that we haven't talked about you want to share?
I'll save some stories, but yeah, I would say that was probably a pretty bad movie in the general scheme of things. Not entirely, but with all the intros and stuff, I think it was a bit disjointed, and I think that was why Sunny came out so well. And there were some great segments in there too. But
there's a lot of fucking sick skiing we haven't talked about that is well worth everybody watching still too. So,
it was kind of
a funny year. It was kind of this experimental year that kind of fell flat a bit,
yeah.
I think.
I mean, if you're not taking risks.
Worth the try.
Yep, worth the try.
For sure.
One of the things I wanted to touch on real quick. So, Ahmet after having his opening segment in iTrip, had closing segment in After Dark, which is a way to follow things up. You actually followed suit yourself, Parker.
With Sonny, yeah.
Yep, absolutely. Opener-closer combo. But, one of the things we were mentioning earlier that really stood out was back to this, like, crazy, I don't know, like, beef, if you want to call it that, like, just between some of the dudes in our crew and some of the guys, the 4x9 crew, kind of came to a head that year when Almet had done a 450 disaster on this ledge in Twin Cities with Kyle pretty early season. And then I don't know if McChesney and those guys knew what Almet. I mean, I wasn't really privy to the details of the story on the front end, but I know that these guys ended up doing the same trick and then putting it out with like a Tupac diss track. And like,
yeah, hit him up. Like, it's like one of the best diss tracks I've ever made.
So appropriate.
Fuck your bitch, fat motherfucker. anyway.
Dude, I don't remember that at all.
That was some insider
shit.
That went down, actually, Parker, when we were in Japan on one of those down days where we were all just kind of like posted up at Black Diamond Lodge while you're eating your cereal in the cafeteria. And yeah, Decker hit me up just livid, losing his shit. And I basically had to talk him off a ledge because it was like just going down right then and there. And they like, Almet and Decker were just like on one. I mean, for good cause. I mean, those were fighting words. Those
for good. I don't know if that's a good cause.
Well, or something. All right, relatively speaking, it was incited, is what I'm saying. Yeah. Like they didn't invent this. Like something definitely. Yeah. There was an effort made to piss them off that succeeded.
Yeah. Oh, they succeeded so hard.
It's really hard to piss Ahmed off, so they did a good job there.
Yeah.
On the flip side of all of that, I had the joy of spending my street trips with Ian Compton, who, or at least one, who is like, I know we touched on before, but it's like the complete opposite of that. And we were we were in Tahoe or in Reno, like
smiles and mono skis,
screwing bindings into a snowboard to make a mono ski. And I was super hyped on him trying out. I was like, dude, you gotta do this. This is gonna be hilarious. And that thing worked. He took it like two laps in Reno Gardens, did that pole jam 180, which is actually super hard. Mm-hmm. And then the bindings ripped right out.
Nah.
Dude, that little Compton interlude with like Logan Imlock and Will right after Rainville, that's a really sick seg, actually. It's a good song, too.
Dude, I agree. There's so much personality in that seg. Ian's shit is like ripe, just bursting with like his shit. Yeah.
Parker, didn't you hit that rail in Reno with Compton?
True. The green
monster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did not get that. I did hit it though. I tried.
Yeah, you came over
for effort.
Oh my gosh, dude! That's
it was like right after Thanksgiving. I said Thanksgiving in Tahoe. Yeah.
Yep, sure was. We had Thanksgiving at the Moment House in Reno.
Talking like that, like it's like dub kink to C to down.
Yeah,
it's a famous don't do it in the park rail.
Notorious Reno spot, but dude. Compton laced that probably like 10th try to Sev out.
That's the best that a skier has ever gotten.
Phenomenal.
Fact.
Compton would always do this thing when he was hitting rails too, where he'd like think of the absolute worst thing that could happen, the worst outcome, and then he would say it out loud. And it was just like,
Jesus.
And I was just like, don't do that. Stop saying that. He's like, well, I'm just saying, like, you fall off to the left, you know? you wrap your shin around that post there. And I'm like, dude, shut up.
Man, you did that. You fell off to the left like two or three times. Some vicious, probably the most savage street crash you've ever seen from you.
Yeah, that was. I didn't continue on that. I was like, I'll let Compton do this one.
So this is not my battle.
Yeah.
Dude. Savage. Word up.
Yep.
Word cool. Yeah.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on, guys. That was fun.
Hell yeah, dude.
Little trip down memory lane.
Likewise, man. Thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, no doubt. We'll catch you guys later. I'll see you guys later.
Thanks for listening, y'all. Much appreciate it. Tell a friend if you're enjoying the podcast. Real quick, those ways to support. You can always go cop something from the store, our new Spy goggles, our new Wells Lamont collab mitts. Go pre-order Romance the DVD. Go find a ticket to a premiere stop. Go host your own premiere. Rate us on iTunes and write us a review if you're feeling like it. And we will catch you next week for episode 13. Sunny.